This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Westbo Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The title of the book is Darkness to Light. It's a compilation by our author, Donna Thorpe. It's actually a compilation of your work, Donna. I didn't mean to imply it might be something else. Tell us about your book, Darkness to Light. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jay. Yes, my first book is a compilation, as you said, of poems throughout my life, and which have led up to this publication. And the title poem actually, I think, kind of explains the transformation that it signifies. Before some years, I had had struggles with my faith. And in 2002, I became a Christian and I began to write differently from when I was published previously in anthologies in 88, 89, and 90. And I just had a desire to honor God and to publish poetry and praise that would do just that and possibly touch the hearts of readers, which with whatever struggles or challenges they may be facing in their life.
Most of the poems in your book, would you call them positive in their message? Are they religious in their message or are they general interest?
I think they're a combination of all three. My main message, if you will, in the book is godly, and I think it's comforting. I would call it more of a positive, yes. There are a few poems in here that are remembrances, excuse me, if you will, of people that I've had in my life that significantly, touched my life and had an effect on my relationship with them and with God.
You're in California. Has any of the California culture crept into your poetry?
Well, I think the fact that I'm from California, a native Californian, that I think some of it maybe has crept in, but mostly it's spiritual and heartfelt and, I believe, touching. So I don't really see too much of a culture influence in it.
No poetry dedicated to surfing, skateboarding, or any of those other California activities?
No, sir.
No poetry. Well, that would be disappointing to a lot of people. They might want to see some star sightings or other things in your poetry, but not necessary. I would think it would be of interest for my listeners to hear maybe a couple of your selections of what your style is. Could you share some of your poetry today?
Sure. The title poem is of course called From Darkness to Light, and it reads like this. I used to walk in darkness, always hiding from the light, until my Savior showed me how to live my life just right. I used to frolic in the world, not knowing what could be. Dead to sin, my soul was lost. Then Jesus came and rescued me. At first I was ashamed because of all that I had done. I confessed that Jesus is God's own Son, and my sins were washed away. Now I follow Jesus, and even when I fall, He guides me out of darkness. His light gets me through it all.
Your poetry is rhythmic. Has anyone that's a musician read any of your pieces and decided to set it to music?
That is my hope. Actually, I had always had a deep-seated desire to be a lyricist. That is what I started out doing originally in the 80s. I was writing more country type of poetry, and I was hoping to go in that direction.
Well, it sounds like you may have had a past history as a drummer. I'm hearing some thumping sounds. Are you accentuating verbiage by hitting your desk?
I must have accidentally hit. I apologize for that.
No, that's all right. I think I can probably either edit that out or it may just stay in because it's kind of charming. When you began writing this, who did you think your audience might be?
Actually, the age range, I was hoping to touch maybe young people, all the way through people who have had a long life and who have maybe had struggles at times, as I said, or maybe might relate to some of the poems in a special way. One of my poems highlights the fact that I have struggled with breast cancer, and I did. I was blessed and came out a survivor, of course. And so that was really something that was special to me. And I'm hoping that maybe it would encourage someone not to be discouraged, that God is hope and he has brought me through. And the name of the poem is God Brought Me Through. And if you'd like, I
can read. Please share some of that. That's a personal insight into your faith and also into your poetry.
Yes, sir. God brought me through. You brought me through breast cancer. You won for me the fight. When others doubted your presence, you showed to them your might. Though painful, scary surgery and radiation 28 times, a staph infection after it all, and back into surgery again. You brought me out of death, stage zero to proclaim. I thank you with every breath, my God, and forever praise your name.
Excellent. Statement of faith and also a statement of encouragement for those who might be facing similar circumstances, right?
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
When you begin writing a poem, if an idea comes to you, do you have a specific area or place in your home or in your office that you write poetry, or does it just come to you as inspiration and you just begin writing wherever you are?
It's funny that you say that, because I have scribbled it on the back of receipts. I've scribbled it on just... It's funny, I write it anywhere, as you said, sometimes in the middle of the night. Sometimes I'll be driving and I'll think, boy, I wish I had a voice-activated recorder with me. And the first time I get to stop, I start writing my thoughts down. Many times I do the editing. After I've already started, I just go back and I move things around and just kind of, it comes to me. And then sometimes... like the other morning, I wrote one in about 10 minutes, and it just flowed. And I think that's what's so exciting about it. God prompts me with these wonderful inspirational thoughts, and they seem to come through, and I write them down, and it just seems to just come together, I guess you would say.
In addition to your inspirational thoughts that you jot down on scraps of paper, is there a journal, perhaps, that you keep? Many of my authors do journal.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm, I do. I have like a notebook, if you will, and I put all the poems, I print them out, and after they're edited, and I put together my own book, if you will, with, you know, sheet protectors and that sort of thing, kind of like a scrapbook sort of thing.
Right.
And I do that.
Great idea and a way to keep track of your creative thought process. If you were to introduce this book to someone in a couple of paragraphs, how would you do so? Get them interested.
I think I would say that it is an exciting journey through life experiences, through faith, through heartache in some ways. I think one of my thoughts would be that I've gone from just having a home to losing it, to losing my late husband, losing everything. And people would ask me, you lost everything. How can you be so happy? And I said, God has to tear things down before he can build them back up. And so I think I would just tell them that it's inspirational in the fact that it prompts you to never give up. And I think it comes through in the poetry. And it complements, one of the poems is about our soldiers. And I think it's just meant for everyone.
Everyone needs some positive reinforcement about their journey and about their life. Is there a particular instance or poem that you feel is the linchpin to your faith and what you've written?
I think that the title poem is one that is really...
very meaningful to you.
But I do have another one, and it's called The Sun Always Shines. And I think that's kind of a metaphor to some people, because God's light is shining in my heart, and it comes through in this poem called The Sun Always Shines.
Great.
And it's just very, as you said, rhythmic, and it does bring you through, I guess, an experience that would show that there's light at the end and there's always warmth in God's love. And it's just one that I think inspires people to look for God and to look for his comfort.
Share some of that with us if you can.
Sure. The sun always shines in my heart. Though it may rain all around me, I am no longer sad and alone. My Savior fills my life with joy. The warmth of his love grows each minute. I feel the tranquility and calm every day. The light of his love shines through. Without his inspiration, I am numb. Look at all the wonders around us. They were made for us to enjoy. Even when we do not understand, he guides our eternal paths. The sun always shines in my heart. No clouds or gloom hide the warmth. While going through my daily chores, I thank him for the blessings in my life. My Savior is always by my side. Through good and bad, he remains. I am so blessed because of his grace. The sun always shines in my heart.
Thank you for sharing that. Donna, you've written a full book of poetry, 74 pages. Not a large book, but one full of inspiration. Were there challenges in getting this one to print?
Yes, I was working a full-time job, a government job, and I was trying desperately to get everything to come together. And sometimes it was difficult, and I was gone about 60 hours a week. And in between time, I was trying to get everything together for the publisher, and I wanted to do the best I could to get it as close to perfect as possible. And it was just a challenge in that way, because I was traveling about 100 miles a day and gone, like I said, about 12 hours a day. So it was just that, and it just seemed like it's been a lifelong journey, and this is just the joy that has come from finally doing this. The only challenge I saw was just actually physically trying to get it together. Other than that, it's all been wonderful.
Beautiful job. Are there other books in your future?
Yes, I've started a new project, and the title tentatively at this point is called On Our Way to Heaven.
Fabulous. This particular effort is Darkness to Light. Our author, who has joined me from California, is Donna Thorpe. Donna, where can my listeners get copies of your book?
On the website of the publisher, westvocalpress.com, you can go there into their bookstore, and you can type in either my name or the title of the book, which is From Darkness to Light, and they can send you a copy. I also have a personal email with the book. It's Donna, D-O-N-N-A, the letter N, like Nancy. My husband is named Paul, P-A-U-L. 623@gmail.com. That's Donna and Paul, 623@gmail.com. They can email me, and I would be happy to send them a copy. And if they wish, I would sign it for them.
That sounds like a great plan, and probably Barnes & Noble and Amazon would have a copy of your book as well if they do a search under Donna Thorpe. Thorpe is spelled T-H-O-R. P.E., and they can keep in contact with you through the web and also get a copy of this book and anything else you publish in the future. Thank you, Donna, for joining me today.
I have a website under construction under bluebutterfly.today.
We'll be in touch. Thank you again for sharing your background story on this, your first effort, Darkness to Light, by Donna Thorpe. Thanks again for joining me.
Thank you, Jay.
For Indie Book Publishing, Westbow Press, this is Jay Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Six of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear these latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Trafford Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today's book is titled The Software Society, Cultural and Economic Impact. Joining me from California is William Mizell. Thank you, sir, for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jay.
This can be a complicated subject. I've got family members that barely know where the on-off switch is to a computer. The software is related to computers. Where did you come up with the concept or the idea of writing this particular book, and share a little of your background?
My background is basically in using computers with and helping them people interact with them. So the idea of the way things were going with computers becoming essentially more friendly and more natural to use led me to think about how this really was impacting our society. And then more generally, technology in general has always changed what it means to be human. You know, going way back, improvements in agriculture and transportation allowed us to move into cities. That certainly changed our lives, and electrical power certainly changed our economy and our way of life. Computers are obviously now having a big impact on us. Mobile phones and are letting us essentially carry computer power everywhere. So all these trends, I tried to look at what it meant for this trend in the way we interact with computers and in increasing computer power, and the rapid change it allowed in our technology, what that was doing to both our culture and our economy.
As a specialist in the computer industry and software in specific, do you have a background as a programmer as well?
Yeah, I've done that. I programmed. I ran the computer science division of an aerospace company for 10 years. I had my own speech recognition company that I founded and ran for 10 years. So I've been involved in creating the stuff as well as most more recently analyzing it.
What are you seeing in the software industry as far as, I guess, origination in the United States or other countries? How are they impacting us economically?
Well, in some sense, software is allowing more of the internationalization of software development, in the sense that, you know, obviously a lot of companies are using programmers in India, for example, to develop software, and also, you know, just things like contact center representatives. You've probably called up and found one with an Indian accent.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously this technology is allowing internationalization of much of technology. The key one interesting thing is that with some of this speech recognition stuff, it really changes the opportunity in some of these developing countries. We think of it as something that's really for developed countries with our smartphones and so forth and our iPads and so forth. But in these developing countries, if they can use just a simple mobile phone and their voice, then many countries where they're illiterate and they really can't otherwise use computers, they can use their mobile phones to converse with computers using speech recognition. And the that really expands the technology to a whole audience and makes the power of and the information available in the web to an awful lot of people that didn't have it before.
What are your observations about security issues related to software and also piracy?
That's a really key thing. I think it's probably a subject that's hard to go into briefly, but I'm very concerned in the long run, and I think everybody's read press issues about cybersecurity. We certainly read enough about companies that should be smart enough to prevent it getting hacked for our credit cards, but there's also a real issue of potentially trying to collapse the financial system and so forth by hacking into exchanges and banks and so forth. Nowadays, you don't hear about bank robberies much because you can steal from them a lot more easily by just hacking into their computers. So I think we have to worry a lot about that in the long run. But the issues in there are almost the subject of another book.
You've penned 276 pages, very extensive observations of the software society and where we're headed. Do you think this will appeal to a broad audience, or is this going to be more directed towards educators, people who are in the software industry, people who are in the tech industry?
Well, I intended it for a general audience. My concern is that we understand both the opportunities and the challenges that this acceleration of technology through software is creating. And particularly on the opportunity side, I think that there's a fundamental change in the way we're going to interact with computers. And I wanted to understand the people that are interested in this subject to understand what the implications were both for technology and for the way we individually interact with computers. I think there's a huge opportunity here for society to take advantage of the fact that these advantages in language technology, in particular, understanding what we say, not just being able to convert it to text, which is more like a dictation application, but understanding what we say so that things like Apple Siri and Microsoft's Cortana and Google's Google Now are basically changing the computer interface. So we just basically ask for what we want and get it quickly without all this navigation. A lot of this is motivated by mobile phones, where the smaller screen makes it more difficult to use the sort of classical graphical user interface or to type. But also the mobile phones allow us to carry this computer intelligence with us everywhere. Chief technology officer of one of the speech recognition companies said something to the effect that with this computer intelligence available to everyone and people being able to access it and to do tasks more efficiently, what if it was the equivalent of increasing the IQ of everyone by 50 points? What would that do to society? So I think this is an important trend beyond just the technical people, although obviously one of the things that I do say in the book is that every company is going to eventually have to have one of these interactive personal assistants as much as they need a web page. That is, you're going to want to be able to interact with your insurance company, with your bank, with almost any service or company by simply asking for what you want. That's going to become an expectation as this competition between the general personal assistants gets heavier and they get smarter and smarter, and people realize that they don't have to go through these painful navigations when they call customer service. You know, please, which of the following selections would you like? And then which of the following selections would you like? Or other issues such as that, you're going to be able to expect to get an answer quickly and efficiently and know that it's accurate because it's the official answer provided by the computer, not some agent trying to, that may or may not understand the company policy completely or what's available to you completely.
The trend towards electronic PAs. Do you find that to be the most exciting software projections for the future, or are there other things that stand alongside that just as exciting?
I think the personal assistant is the key revolution in the way we're going to handle computers, because one of the potentials that I emphasize in the book is the possibility of these personal assistants becoming essentially the same personal assistant across devices. So that you can, and you're already seeing that. Apple's already announced that, for example, if you have an iPhone and a Mac, you can, and you get a phone, it can be announced on your PC. So these personal assistants with the proactive notifications reminding you that you have an appointment or worrying about the traffic so that you may have to leave a little earlier for your appointment, things like that are going to become so natural to us that we're going to almost become to depend on them, and that creates huge economic opportunities, also challenges for companies that don't want to be the last one to realize this trend.
Is there going to be a decline in traditional jobs like we see them today?
Yeah, I mean, that's another issue with the that I address in the book is the the software in general, not just this. The fact that, of course, computers are doing things like recognizing speech does reduce jobs, but we see more and more things being done in software that previously required humans in general. And in general, automation is increasing at a faster pace, and that is taking away jobs. Now, you know, historically, when you call it automation and taking away jobs, it sounds bad, but if you, you know, historically, that's been what drives the economy, what's called productivity.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that lately, productivity has, the return for improved productivity has been going to capital. So companies are seeing increasing profits. It's not going to labor, if I use the sort of classical economic division there of labor and capital. So what we're seeing is jobs that, the new jobs that are being created are generally not middle-class jobs. We're seeing a decline in the median income, which in a sense some authors have called the hollowing out of the middle class. That's a pretty significant issue that we really do need to address and realize that it's not going to, you know, this latest recession, if we're not going to get just the cyclical recovery, because part of the problem is structural. Part of the problem is that productivity improvements are not creating new jobs, and the jobs they are creating that are required with this, with changes in the technology towards software, are not ones that people can be trained for quickly. So you, historically, when jobs changed, somebody who drove a buggy could learn to drive a car, but it takes a while to, for some, you know, it's not so obvious to someone who was trained in social sciences is going to learn to program a computer, for example. So these issues of how fast society can adapt are real issues that the government really and the economists are almost afraid to talk about, because everybody wants to talk up the economy, but there are some real structural issues that should be addressed.
William, as you have completed this book, it looks like a very technical read to me, one that I would have to have some at least moderate expertise in the software area. Would you describe this for me in a couple of paragraphs so that my listeners can get interested in getting their own personal copy?
Well, my intent was to take some very complex technical subjects and make them understandable to the average person. So my intent is not to, I did not write this for technical people, but I do cover a lot of subjects in the book. The two themes that I talked about the most, I think one could just focus on those, but there are other things like talking about software patents and stuff that do make the book seem a little complex. But I think that somebody who really wants to understand how our world is changing and the role of software in that could get some real insights from this, and it helps them understand what they're hearing in the news. So I really do believe that it's not necessarily an easy read, but what I've been told is once people get involved in it, they do get drawn in pretty quickly. So I'm hoping that the readers will find it useful and interesting. And if you want to just sample some of the ideas in a much briefer form, I do have a blog, a free blog called thesoftwaresociety.com, that people can check out some of these topics in which I update periodically.
Were there some other challenges in getting this, your first general populace book, completed?
Yeah, well, I think, you probably hit on one of them. I'm used to writing for a more technical audience.
Right.
So perhaps the book takes some very challenging subjects and is therefore not something where if you read the abstract, you might be a little intimidated. But I think the book in itself is actually much more digestible than the subject matters that it covers sound like.
Thank you for sharing the background story of your book, The Software Society, Cultural and Economic Impact. An important read for anyone that's in the tech industry or in the technical world, which is every one of us. So thank you again for sharing this. Where do my listeners get copies of your book?
It's available in the usual places like Amazon and so forth. So, bookstores and some bookstores. So thank you, Jay, for having me on your program.
Well, thank you for joining me. And listeners, you can also do a search under William Mizell. Mizell is spelled M-E-I-S-E-L. And find this particular book, The Software Society, and any other books that may come in the future. Now, please recap for us once again your blog site.
It's thesoftwaresociety.com.
Thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you.
For Indie Book Publishing, Trafford Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Hello, everyone. I'm Clint Yates on the Indie Book Publishing line. Today, we're glad you could be with us. I am blind, and I chose to play in the game of life, not sit on the bench. It wasn't always easy, but the joy of living that I have experienced makes all the work and pain more than worth my effort. Those words from Homer Page, just a brief insight into the book that he has just written entitled It's My World Too, Accepting Challenges, Embracing Life. And Homer joins us on the Indie Book Publishing line today. Hello, Homer. How are you today?
I'm well, and you?
I'm doing terrific. Doing terrific.
Okay.
So this book, It's My World Too, Accepting Challenges, Embracing Life, this is really your story from birth up to almost present day.
Yeah, that's correct. I wanted to write a book that in which I could talk about my experiences as a blind person growing up and establishing myself as an adult and finding my way into the mainstream of life as a blind person. I thought that my entire life is my record, my effort at doing that, and so I really wanted to write a comprehensive book.
Well, going back to the beginning, Homer, did you have that? I know you describe on your book cover and in your book and some of the information that I've read about you about having this vibrant desire to live life. Did that start as far back as you can remember, or was there a turning point somewhere in your childhood where that zest for life came alive in you despite being blind?
Well, I think I always enjoyed living and life, even when I was too young really to understand that that concept. I was always an active child with an active imagination. I had imaginary friends at an early age that I played with. Living on a farm, there weren't any real children, so
yeah.
I made them up. I just always enjoyed what I did. I think my father and mother loved me, and I used to do things with my dad when I was really young, he would take me with him to the fields. We would ride horses together, and he always talked about how much fun everything was, and I just grew up thinking life was really fun.
You talk about in chapter two of your book, The Hill, which is close to your home, right across from your home, I think you were telling me, and that played a real big role in your childhood.
It really did. As you came in the gate off the county road onto our property, there was a hill where you went down, and at the bottom there was a stream, a little stream, and then you would go up the other side, and at the top of that hill was where our house was placed. And I played on that hill, running up and down it. We would go down the hill on our sleds in the winter with snow. But one of the major work items that I learned was at the bottom of the hill was the stream. And on our farm, which we did not have electricity, we did not have a deep well, we did not have, obviously, city water. Water was a big thing, and there were there were holes in the stream where there were deeper pools of water. My brother and I, from the time we were maybe 5 or 6 years old, would be sent down the hill to get buckets of water to bring up to the house to use for drinking, for washing, for every cooking. We had to carry the water from the spring to the house, and so carrying those buckets of water up that steep hill when we were really young was the first real experience with work. And it was interesting because I learned from that early age that I could contribute to my family, that by doing work, by carrying the water up the hill, we were making a contribution, a significant contribution, and we were rewarded by our parents by being told that was important, that we were really helping out, and it made us really feel good.
Homer, we're talking about the 1940s here, right?
Correct.
When you're going.
Yes.
What was it like in the 40s to be a young boy growing up with your disability? Are you being blind in a generational kind of sense? Was it a lot different in the 40s for a young person, perhaps, than it is in this particular generation?
I really think it is. Starting school, I started school in 1947, just at the end of World War II, and there were no alternative programs in the public schools for children. There was no way for me to learn to use Braille or any alternative techniques. It was possible for me to go to the School for the Blind in St. Louis, but my parents and I really felt that was inappropriate for me, and so I stayed in the public school, but I really learned to listen. I didn't have a computer or any other devices. I just sat in class and listened and engaged in the conversations around what we were learning, books and math and social studies, all of the kinds of things that children learn in school. I learned just by sitting and listening. Yeah. I think that our family lived in rural Missouri, and at that time electricity didn't reach our farm, So we didn't have a refrigerator or running water or inside toilet or any of the taken for granted modern conveniences. So I had to learn to live in that kind of rural environment, which was really not very much different from 500 years before.
Yeah.
It was 1952 when electricity came to our farm, and that really did change the nature of life on the farm.
Now, you go on to become, from being in a public school setting where you didn't get a lot of assistance, you want to be a college professor, right?
Correct.
So, were you able, despite all these obstacles, perhaps someone might categorize as, was able to continue your education and go on to university? And how did you manage to do that?
Well, I developed the ability, as I said, to listen and to absorb material. I used readers to some extent through college. But when I got into graduate school, I became familiar with a program that was called Recordings for the Blind. And Recordings for the Blind really did make a huge difference in my education and made it possible for me to go on, finish graduate school, receive a doctorate, and move into the world of higher education. Recordings for the Blind was and is a program that records on demand textbooks and other books that students are using in college and graduate school classrooms. And so I was able to get books and then listen to them. They originally were recorded on flexible discs, and then on tapes, and now they are recorded on CDs. Hmm. So the ability of Recordings for the Blind to make possible those materials to college students, of which I was one, really changed the opportunity for blind people in higher education.
I see here on your jacket of your book, you're also a wrestler, too. So you're an athlete. What, two letters at University of Missouri for wrestling?
Correct. I grew up loving sports. I became a baseball fan when I was 8 years old by listening to it on the radio. I lived near enough St. Louis that we could pick up the Cardinal games on the radio. And I always dreamed of being able to be a baseball player. I wanted to be Marty Marion, the shortstop of the Cardinals. I love basketball and football, but of course I couldn't play those sports. My high school didn't have a wrestling team. It was a small school, and we just didn't have wrestling. So when I went to the University of Missouri, this was the fall of 1959, one of the things on my agenda was to become acquainted with the wrestling program and see if I couldn't participate. So I did. I enrolled for a physical education class in wrestling, and the coach invited me to come to the practices. And by my sophomore year, I was a starter on the team, and it was a terrific experience for me.
Wow. Well, a little bit more about the book, Homer. What really sets, or do you believe, sets your book apart from others that might be similar in nature of someone, perhaps, that has your disability? What makes your book a little different?
I think really what makes it different is that I really try to put my life in the context of the historical events of our era. Many of those events I had some role in, and was, you know, involved in the public life of our country from the 1960s until the present. And so I think what I have tried to do is to set my life, as you quoted at the beginning of this, as someone who wanted to play, not sit on the bench. And for me, playing meant get involved in the important movements, to get involved in politics and elective politics, to work on presidential campaigns, to really play an active role in the events of the time. And I guess what I have tried to do is to talk about some of those events and my participation in them from the point of view of a blind person who really wants to be a player.
In your book, Homer, it really doesn't just appeal exclusively to people who are blind.
I would hope not. I really wrote the book for anyone who is interested in the last 70 years of our history, who was involved or is involved or interested in the civil rights movement, the political events of the time, and really what I have tried to do is to tell the story of a blind person who is a player in the mainstream. I am a little different in the sense that I'm blind, but I think the challenges that I have dealt with, most people in one way or another have to face also. Being blind is different, but not that different. It makes you a little unique, but a lot like everybody else.
Again, the name of the book is It's My World, Too, Accepting Challenges, Embracing Life, the author, Homer Page, we've been talking to today. Homer, tell us, the book has only been out a few months. Where can we find a copy or more about you?
Well, I am launching a website. It's hlp.net, and the book is available on Amazon and eBay and on the Abbott Press website. Abbott Press is the publisher, and it would be in the book. You can get it in the bookstore, but probably you would want to order it. Mm-hmm. I really invite people to come to my website. We are going to be doing a blog and be interactive with people who have an opportunity to read the book and have questions or comments or just want to dialogue about it. I think that is going to be one of the most interesting and rewarding parts of writing the book, and I really look forward to it.
Technology has changed so much.
Oh, yes.
You describe your childhood living in the rural area of Missouri and with no electricity to having a blog.
Boy,
how far we have come.
That's right.
Again, the name of the book is It's My World, Too, Accepting Challenges, Embracing Life. The author, Homer Page, has been with us today. Homer, thank you so much for being with us, and good luck on your book.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.